It is 7:34 in the morning. You are listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks.
And I'm Brian Edwards Teeger. Kat Brooks, you remember the case of Jose Inez Garcia Zarate?
I do indeed. I texted you when I saw the verdict.
Homeless, undocumented immigrant released in accordance with San Francisco sanctuary city law from the San Francisco City Jail on appear in San Francisco, shoots and kills Kate Steinle. And he went to trial. Went to trial on first-degree murder charges from the prosecutor's office, despite the fact that the bullet had ricocheted off the ground 14 feet away from him and tumbled 78 feet before hitting her. And gunpowder residue tests showed so little gunpowder had made it into the skin on his hands that his narrative, which is that he had just picked up a bundle of cloth with something in it under the bench where he was sitting on the pier, seemed to have some credibility to it. In any case, the jury, after an extensive trial and almost a week of deliberations, acquitted him on first-degree murder, acquitted him on second-degree murder, acquitted him on manslaughter, and convicted him for being a felon in possession of a gun. And we're joined now by the attorney who headed up his defense. Matt Gonzalez is chief attorney for the San Francisco Public Defender's Office. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, how does it feel to be in the middle of a national right-wing media maelstrom?
Well, I haven't been following it too closely. I mean, I think we got to the end of the trial. We kind of presented our take on what had happened and what led to the verdicts. But I've really not done interviews. I did one interview across the courthouse immediately with Fox News, and I'm doing this interview. I mean, I've tried to keep it light.
We appreciate you coming over so early.
Yeah, no, I mean, for you guys, of course.
Can we start with nuts and bolts? Like, what happens to your client now? So his immigration status is still undocumented. He does have a conviction now, and apparently there's a separate set of federal charges being brought against him?
Well, there are a few things. You know, Jeff Sessions is out there saying that they're going to charge him with illegal reentry and all this stuff. But they're not really paying a lot of attention because he didn't illegally enter the country this time. They released him into San Francisco by their error. And so he can't be charged with illegal reentry. What happens when you serve a federal prison sentence, when you get to the end of it, like Garcia Zarate did, you typically get deported, and then you're also on federal parole with all kinds of requirements to report to your parole officer and what have you. Of course, those requirements are illusory because you're being deported. No one really expects you to stay in contact with anybody. Although in his case, because he wasn't deported and dropped into San Francisco, he's technically in violation of those conditions of parole. That's what he's going to face in the federal courts, not a new illegal reentry charge. For the state case, he was convicted of possession of a firearm. And candidly, the jury had asked a couple of questions related to how long do you have to be in possession of something, you know, of a gun in order to be guilty of this offense, and questions like that, which suggested to me that they didn't convict him of possessing a firearm like going out to the pier with a gun. They actually convicted him of being in possession of the gun after the accidental firing. In other words, they said, oh my God, at that point, he knew it was a gun and it was in his hands. And so we're going to bring up to the judge that there were a few instructional errors that took place. The judge didn't allow an instruction on mistake of fact. In the law, we call that a sua sponte instruction. He's obligated to give that instruction whether we ask for it or not. We asked for an instruction related to momentary possession because at that point, you know, he probably held the gun less than a second. And that's what he got convicted of, and the court refused to give that instruction. So, you know, I don't expect this judge will, you know, do anything with that, but we'll lay that out. And
but what could he do? Could he set aside the jury's verdict?
He could grant a new trial on the single count that Garcia Zarate was convicted of. I don't expect he will, but I do. I mean, I would bet anything I own that the one conviction will not be upheld on appeal.
And you intend to appeal it?
Yes, for sure. I mean, you know, the point here isn't, I mean, he's already served his sentence, so it's not going to have an impact on that. But for us, there is an important thing here, which is to say, look, what happened here was a complete accident. And I don't want anybody on the right walking around thinking that Garcia Zarate was in possession of a gun when he went out to the pier, because it feeds into that right-wing narrative of, like, how crazy is this jury that they thought he had a gun on the pier but didn't convict him of anything. It's important that everybody realize, no. That possession was this split-second possession after the shooting.
Matt Gonzalez, I was really struck by the prosecution's determination to sort of dig in their heels around it being first-degree murder despite the forensic evidence. Any idea why they were so committed to that?
You know, it's a very peculiar thing. In San Francisco, it has typically been the case that when you're going to seek a first-degree murder charge, that you file the charges explicitly saying so, giving the defense an opportunity to try to argue that, you know, that charge should be set aside prior to trial. The law in California does allow you simply to charge murder and then at a very late moment decide if you want first degree or not. But in San Francisco, that's typically not been the way prosecutors do it. They've always been kind of above board. And I don't want to suggest that it's underhanded, but it's just not customary. I think that they made a real mistake. I mean, second-degree murder can get you life in prison. So why get in front of a jury and create this intentional argument that just, I think, takes you out of the realm of credibility to start saying that this guy with no violence in his background, he's never stolen anything, there's no evidence he's ever handled a gun, never been in possession of a weapon, and suddenly try to say, you know, he's good for a first-degree murder. I think they lost a lot of credibility with that.
So I've seen a lot of legal analysts, including people who are, you know, by no means raging lefties, say the exact same thing, like major tactical mistake to charge first-degree murder, and then build the narrative as the prosecution around first-degree murder, that it made it harder to get an indictment on something like manslaughter. You know, which leads me to ask, the people in the DA's office aren't stupid. Do you think it was a political call to overcharge the case?
I don't know, because, you know, the DA spokesperson had been giving interviews for 2 years about how they were seeking second-degree murder. And it happened in the courtroom. The DA asked the judge for first-degree murder. He gave us an opportunity to try to argue why they didn't have a legal right to do it. You know, they do have a legal right to pursue it. So, you know, we couldn't stop it. But we were wondering whether or not that had gotten the approval of anyone outside of the DA in that courtroom. And by the way, let me just say this about the whole case. The district attorney brought in a professional jury consultant to help them with jury selection, who sat with them during parts of the trial. They took this very seriously, and they believe that they were engaging in very careful, you know, legal engineering to get the perfect jury to go their way. And you know, I had basically, you know, a law student from Yale. I got a volunteer attorney who drove me over here, who does a lot of federal work, an old public defender friend, and, you know, Francisco Ugarte, who's the head of our immigration unit in the public defender office and a great, you know, paralegal and investigator. But, you know, we were not bringing in, you know, a jury consultant or something like that. But so they were getting advice, and apparently they thought they could get a first-degree murder conviction.
One of the other things that for me is most troubling about this case is where the actual gun came from. belonged to a police officer, correct? And somebody had stolen the gun out of the police officer's car and it was loaded. Why?
Bureau of Land Management.
Bureau of Ranger. Land Management.
Yeah.
Why no accountability for him?
Well, it's really interesting because the DA's theory and the right had been saying all along that Garcia Zarate had stolen this gun. While we were doing pretrial motions on the case, we became aware of the fact that instead of a single auto burglary, there were a number of auto burglaries that had taken place in the same area, like six or seven of them. And it was quite interesting because the Bureau of Land Management officer had the gun stolen and some like credit cards, a second magazine for the gun that got ditched at a second car. And out of that car was stolen some, there were laptop computers, passports stolen. And so we realized, wait a second, this is fascinating because Garcia Zarate did not have anything of value in his possession. He didn't have laptops, passports. And so we started to realize they, you know, our client is completely innocent of any allegation of an auto burglary. And the prosecutor had not, they had not turned over what we call discovery related to these auto burglaries. We had to subpoena this from the police department. They turned over a redacted police report of that of one of the other auto burglaries. We tracked down the victim of that auto burglary via, I guess, rental car information and pieced together this very slowly. The district attorney went from saying the Bureau of Land Management officer was irrelevant to the whole case, yet still wanting to suggest that our client was involved in the auto burglary. Now, the judge agreed that he was not involved in the auto burglary. He didn't want us to get into those auto burglaries, so he just told the jury, you're not to speculate. But the DA took every opportunity to tell the jury how close those auto burglaries had occurred to what happened on the pier, suggesting that. Now, the Bureau of Land Management officer was not held accountable. There seemed to be a bit of a loophole in the law where law enforcement officers apparently had been outside of the law in terms of a requirement that you safely secure your guns in a vehicle. Technically, he's not a law enforcement officer, and so I think could have been prosecuted for that.
If it was me or Brian and someone stole a gun out of our car and killed someone, we would be held legally responsible, correct?
Absolutely. And so I think there was a state legislator in San Mateo who has gone in and helped change that law so there's no loophole. But, you know, I mean, even under Bureau of Land Management rules, they make it very clear you got to secure your gun at all times. And, you know, it raises a whole nother question, which is, why does a Bureau of Land Management officer have multiple guns to begin with? This is like his backup gun. He's got it fully loaded. I mean, these guys patrol, you know, a million acres of land. They probably need like a rifle in their truck, maybe. So to have like this elite pistol fits into what we're seeing with a lot of law enforcement agencies where they all want the most elite military equipment and get the hand-me-downs. You know, the Sig Sauer pistol was made without an external safety so that police officers, you know, who have like a real dangerous assignment can reach for that second weapon and start firing immediately with, you know, and the gun doesn't have a safety for that reason. But of course, like all things related to the military, local law enforcement guys and forestry guys and Bureau of Land Management guys, they all want these weapons and eventually get them.
And this guy's carrying it not on duty, but on a family road trip, on vacation, loaded,
with
unsecured.
His child.
Yeah, and the way this gun is loaded, just to give you an idea, the magazine has seven bullets in it. So if you took this gun and put the magazine in, I think you can say you got a gun that's ready to go. No. He puts the magazine in the gun, loads a bullet, a cartridge into the chamber, takes the magazine out because now it only has six, puts another bullet in it, and puts it back in the gun so that he has 7 plus 1. You know, that's just not necessary when you're on a vacation.
Wow. Oh
my God. Speaking of Matt Gonzalez, he is the chief attorney for the San Francisco Public Defender's Office, and he headed up the defense of Jose Inez Garcia Zarate, the gentleman who was just acquitted for the murder of Kate Stiley, although he was convicted on a charge of being a felon in possession of a handgun. We just got word that the defense will be attempting to challenge that conviction as well. Matt Gonzalez, what about the immigration repercussions he's facing? Does the San Francisco Public Defender's Office do like wraparound defense on immigration issues?
Well, we do handle some immigration cases in California. I think Garcia Zarate may be taken out of the state to deal with his federal parole issues. We're not certain of that. And so, you know, we'll obviously work with whoever the public defenders are who have to deal with that federal parole issue. But we don't expect him to be charged with any new offenses because he's already stood trial for them. You know, it would be a double jeopardy issue.
And he's getting deported regardless.
Yes. And, you know, to the credit of the local Mexican consul, they're committed to helping him get reestablished in Mexico.
One of the things we've seen recently is when more progressive attorneys or activists take on things like this, threats, intimidation from the right. So, for instance, the National Lawyers Guild, you know, after the anti-fascist marches, received lots of violent threats. Anything come your way as a result of this case?
Well, I don't, you know, I just kind of glance at the stuff. There's a lot of hate mail coming in right now, which seems more than usual. But I just don't think about that. You know, we this is just about due process. And, you know, I think it's unfortunately we have this, you know, lack of civility in our public discourse right now. I think most of the people that are upset don't actually know the facts. And they're saying things that are just not true. You know, they're saying, oh, this gun does not fire if you drop it. Well, you know, that's not actually what we claimed happened. And by the way, there are instances where the gun has fired because it's been dropped. So, you know, they argue, oh, the trigger pull on this gun, it's very hard. You have to put your finger in to make it fire. Well, yes. You have to pull the trigger, but you can fire this gun by hitting the side of the trigger with your finger. If it's wrapped in something, your finger could inadvertently pull the trigger, so to speak. So we were not making dumb arguments to this jury. I mean, the foreperson of this jury has a PhD, I think, in an area like economics or health economics. This was a wide-ranging jury with different backgrounds. You know, there were folks on this jury that were in the tech world. There were others that were, you know, would fit a characterization of sort of laborer. You know, it was really spanned a lot of different types of occupations, you know. And they had to unanimously agree on this verdict, you know. So it's often the case that the right wing, you know, wants to make it seem as if this is some, unexpected or wacky outcome. But the truth is the facts compelled it. You know, Brian, as you stated in the opening to this segment, I mean, the bullet struck the ground, basically. I mean, I told the jury, if you think about it, he missed her by 78 feet. It required this freakish ricochet to cause the bullet to hit her in the lower back. And when the medical examiner figured out from the way the bullet was tumbling and entered her lower back that it had struck something first, they went out to the pier to try to find the strike mark. And they were looking all around like 5-10 feet of where she was shot and could not find it. And again, you know, the jury's got to reflect on that, because Even these trained professionals that have seen it all would not expect to see a strike mark 78 feet away, you know, and it just spoke clearly that, God, this is a terrible accident.
Have you had any communication or heard anything from the family of Kate Steinle?
I have not. Not since the verdict. You know, I think it's got to be really difficult for them. I think that they do not appreciate having been brought into the, you know, the political dialogue around the case. You know, as a defense lawyer, there's that careful spot where you want to offer condolences, but you also, you know, when you do that to somebody, you place them in the uncomfortable position where they can't sort of be rude to you if you do that to them, and yet you don't want to force them to be kind to you either, you know, so you're better just to leave things alone. But after the verdict, I mean, we obviously really wanted to try to communicate that no one should take this verdict as repudiating their loss or, you know, trivializing that in any way.
Hmm. Matt Gonzalez, this has been framed nationally as making the case against sanctuary cities. The precondition for the shooting, whether it was intentional or unintentional, was that Garcia Zarate was released by San Francisco Sheriff when Immigration and Customs Enforcement would have liked him kept in custody till they picked him up. What's your response to that?
Well, you know, my take on it is that the way the issue's been framed is wrong. And I think the left is kind of fallen into the way it's been framed, this idea of does a municipality have a right to defy federal law and federal authorities? And we kind of like the way it's teed up because we generally think that we believe in decentralization. We believe that progressive communities should be able to try out progressive laws and what have you. But what's really going on here is that these agencies, ICE and Homeland Security, when they're left to their own devices and able to place a detainer on somebody without any oversight, it turns out they make a lot of mistakes. It's been shown that in a 10-year period, they made about 1,500 mistakes, which means U.S. citizens were held in custody by local authorities that did what they were asked to do, which was place a detainer on somebody. So it's the federal courts, federal district courts in conservative areas as well as liberal areas that have said, no, you cannot just place a detainer on somebody. You have to have probable cause that they are not here legally, not U.S. citizens, and that they're subject to removal. And so the local authorities are following that federal law. It's ICE and Homeland Security. It's the federal agencies that don't want to follow federal law. It's not about municipalities defying federal law. It's about federal agencies that want mass deportation. They don't want judicial oversight. And when you think of it that way, you realize how outrageous it is that we're having this debate in Congress about sanctuary cities. You know, I'll just add that, you know, the sheriff of San Francisco, Ross Mercurimi, at the time, had conversations with ICE and Homeland Security, and had explained to them that, you know, the city and county of San Francisco was going to follow the law, and believe that he had an understanding with them about what they had to do in order to properly place detainers. Garcia Zarate was not released immediately, even though he had a right to be. He was kept in custody about an extra 19 days while San Francisco waited for the federal authorities to get the proper probable cause determination that they can do in probably less than an hour. And they just don't care. They don't want to adhere to that requirement.
Or they got too many people in the dragnet to move fast.
That's possible, but, you know, there are systems for, like, telephonic search warrants when agents are, you know, feel that time is of the essence. I mean, you know, the federal courts can set something up that would be able to accommodate all of this.
All right. Final question, Matt Gonzalez. The jury goes out before Thanksgiving. They don't come back until a week afterwards. What were you doing during that week?
Well, I was catching up on other work. The last murder case I handled had a similar thing. You know, the jury was out deliberating for over a week. You learn that you cannot guess what it's going to take. And, you know, if you take 12 people, put them in a room, and each of them speaks for 5 minutes, you know, do the math, you know, and an hour is gone. So this jury's getting together for basically 6 hours a day. If they watch a 2 hour long video, or, you know, ask for read back that might take a couple of hours, you know, it is a slow process. And, you know, I'm less nervous for the verdict and actually more nervous for the questions, because when the jury has a question, you then have judge to see it your way. So, for instance, when the jury was asking about, hey, how long do you have to possess a gun in order to be sort of guilty of gun possession? I realized what they were doing, which was, oh, they're thinking about the possession of the gun after the incident happened, which was fleeting at best. And so, you know, we did not prevail in getting the court to answer the question the way we would have liked, which is with, you know, set jury instructions, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, things take the time that they take.
Matt Gonzalez, thank you so much for coming over this morning.
Thank you guys for having me.
Matt Gonzalez is the chief attorney for the San Francisco Public Defender's Office. He led the defense of Garcia Zarate, the man who was just acquitted on charges of murder and manslaughter related to the death of Kate Stiley.